The president is continuing to attack fellow NATO members on claims that they're not pitching in enough money for defense. He also claimed Germany was under the control of Russia because they signed a gas pipeline deal. And there has been a lot of hand-wringing about whether the president's actions could lead to the end of NATO. I spoke with CBS correspondent Major Garrett this morning. He's in Brussels with the president. And I asked him just that. Is our military alliance in Europe, and a Europe allied against Russia, coming to an end?
It doesn't appear that way, but there's going to be a very rocky, and already has been, just today, rocky conversation about the future of NATO. Now, the president has said over and over, NATO member nations need to more rapidly meet that 2% of gross domestic product spending on defense. That's a pledge and a goal by 2024. He said no one wants it right now. And the General Secretary of NATO has said the president is right, and more NATO member nations are increasing defense spending. But this morning, here in Brussels, the president described Germany as a captive of Russia because it has recently signed a multi-billion dollar pipeline deal. The president said, why does America have to defend Germany through NATO if they're going to cut these billion-dollar deals with Russia? Well, I don't need to tell you that the Germans, and particularly Angela Merkel, the chancellor, who upon arriving here in Brussels said, you know, I grew up in East Germany. I know what it's like to be a captive of the Soviet Union.
Yeah.
So don't lecture me, Mr. President, about what it is or isn't to be a captive of Russian or Soviet influence. That is going to vastly complicate the interpersonal relationship between Angela Merkel and President Trump. And it's precisely what ambassadors that I met with last week in Washington were hoping to avoid at this NATO summit. More provocative talk from the president, more appearance of division, more appearance of discord right before he goes to Helsinki to have his first face-to-face with Russian President Vladimir Putin. And yet, that's precisely what has happened.
So what exactly are the consequences to us? I mean, if NATO somehow breaks up
And NATO member nations don't want it to fall apart. But there's only so much hectoring our European and NATO allies are going to take from this American president. And as the president says, well, I took political risks to create more defense spending in the United States, many European leaders would say, yes, but those risks weren't all that great. You campaigned on it. You had a cooperative, compliant Republican Congress that wanted to do that anyway. The orientation of defense spending in Europe is a much bigger and tougher political push. And European leaders tell the president, you've got to understand our politics are different than yours. And we appreciate your call for a stronger NATO alliance that has a more robust defense bottom line, but you've got to give us time. And the impatience of President Trump is what the real irritant here. I don't think philosophically there's a great disagreement about more defense spending for NATO as a bulwark against Russian aggression. I don't think there is. But there's a deep disagreement about the methods of the president, the hectoring, the almost insulting way he brings up this issue, and the sense that America ought to be more accepting of and cooperative with its European allies than this president has so far been.
Isn't there also a certain irony in Donald Trump calling some other country a captive of the Russians?
Well, I guarantee you the editorial outlets here in Europe, from London to Berlin to Paris, will make, if they haven't already, no one in Europe is under investigation for possible collusion with the Russians in any political context. Elements of the Trump campaign are, and that question still remains unanswered. So I'm sure many Europeans will consider that not only ironic and rich, but insulting and less than intellectually stout.
Major Garrett in Brussels. This is Seattle's Morning News. Dave Ross with Colleen O'Brien. The big summit between President Trump and Vladimir Putin is coming up on the 16th in Finland, and I'm already reading some concerns that he's going to give something away and not get anything in return. So let's consult with Mitchell Orenstein, who teaches Russian studies at the University of Pennsylvania and also is an associate with Harvard University. Do you share the concerns of some of the president's critics that he might give away too much when he sits down with Putin?
Yeah, I think that's fair. I mean, I think the general background would be a couple things. One is that the U.S. doesn't really need a lot of things from Russia right now. So in other words, there's not a lot Russia can give us that's of value, where in contrast, Russia needs a lot from us. We have a big sanctions regime against Russia that they would like some relief from. The United States is a much bigger economy, so it matters a lot more to other countries. So I think there's a fundamental discontinuity there. They need a lot more from us than we need from them.
So, well, what is in it for us then? Because that, of course, is the theme of the Trump administration. What's in it for us? It sounds like he is not as concerned as Obama was with punishing Russia for taking over Crimea. But does anybody care about that anymore, I guess is what I'm getting at. Does it matter?
Yeah, I think it matters. I think the issue with Trump administration foreign policy, and I know a number of the people who work in the administration, or I have known them in the past, and I know their positions on things. They have one position that's probably a sensible mainstream position about U.S.-Russia relations. And then Trump has his own individual foreign policy. So I think the real issue here is Trump interested in getting some things for himself? For instance, aid for his presidential campaign, or you know, some further collusion or conspiracy to cover up, you know, the aid that's already been provided, and whether he's not trading that off against important U.S. foreign policy goals such as having a more peaceful situation and a more sovereign and independent Ukraine, or the security of other European states. So what it looks like to me, and I think to a lot of analysts, is that Trump cares about what's in it for him personally, not what's in it for the United States.
Let me just make sure I'm hearing you clearly. So you really think that he would bargain away U.S. foreign policy objectives for help with his reelection campaign for Russia?
Yes, absolutely. I think that's what's already happened. I mean, if you put any credence in the collusion allegations that have been made, that's exactly what it's about. It's about aid to the campaign in exchange for giving away certain chits in the U.S. foreign policy goal, such as dropping the sanctions regime against Russia. There's been talk about reducing U.S. troops in Europe and, you know, of course, his attacks on NATO countries. So, yeah, I think it's exactly that.
So if this is true, then how much rope is he willing to give Putin? For example, I also keep hearing concerns that Putin is not satisfied with Crimea. He has his eye on Estonia and the Baltic states, and maybe the little green men will show up there. We would just turn the other way if that happened?
The best way to look at him is not as a sort of an agent of Putin or something like that, but he's more of a kind of broker, right? In the sense that he wants money from Putin and whomever else is willing to pay, you know, essentially for bits of U.S. foreign policy. I think that that he's probably going to be balancing a bunch of different things. There's no doubt that Trump doesn't want a further Russian invasion of European countries. I don't think that Trump is really interested in fighting a big European war or anything like that. And so the way I would think that he looks at it is that, you know, he's trying to ensure some sort of peace and some sort of way of getting along, some modus operandi with Russia. And he's willing to make deals to make that happen. And those deals would be largely financial, in many cases benefit himself personally, but would be set on more appeasement, right? And so he thinks that you can appease Russia through making business deals. And I think that's what this summit is ultimately about.
Okay, but can you explain to me more specifically what business deals would help him personally? And is the president even allowed to do that?
Well, of course, he's not allowed to, but he has extensively, right? I mean, so a lot of foreign governments have spent money at Trump properties. In Moscow, it's widely reported that he's had a number of real estate deals. There's also a lot of Russian money that has come into his Florida properties, in particular in New York. So there's a lot of different ways that the Russians try to put money into the hands of politicians in the West. And for Trump, there's certainly plenty of opportunities to do that. I would think that they would, you know, they're very creative. Typically, they'll give you a slice of a small slice of a major deal, you know, diamonds or gold or some sort of oil deal, you know, going to some account somewhere. That's one possibility, or a big real estate deal, or other things. I mean, Trump has real estate deals going in a number of different countries, and you know, where he seems to have positive relations, such as the Philippines, with the government. So I can't say specifically exactly how they would plan to make some type of a payoff, but I would think that that would be part of a quid pro quo in which the United States would reduce its aggressive posture in the region. From the Russian perspective, Trump would get some things individually, and in exchange we'd get a kind of promise that they wouldn't do anything further, like attack Estonia or something like that. In many cases, things they're not really actually planning to do. You know.
But you're saying he would soft pedal Russian policy in exchange for hotel bookings. I still
not like $500, you know, but I mean, yeah, I think 500 million or something like that. Sure. Yeah.
If you know this and you're happy to talk about it publicly, other people must know this who have an investigatory capacity and who realize it's illegal and are going to do this. I mean, are you saying this is the reason that he really, really, really doesn't want anybody to see his tax returns? Because they're,
yes.
I see.
So, yes, and I think that, I mean, I think if you look, it's not like I'm making this up. I mean, you can read every day in the paper about it. I don't know if we read different papers or not, but if you look in the New York Times, you know, you can see every day that there's reports about, you know, foreign governments, you know, specifically organizing their events at the Trump Hotel property in D.C. in exchange for what they think is going to be some sort of benefit.
Well, I do read that. In fact, I talk with David Farenthold on a regular basis, and that is his beat. But I still find it hard. I mean, that's just so bald-faced. It's not even subtle. So it seems to me to be very risky.
Right. Yeah, it is a risky behavior, but, you know, we know that Trump does risky behaviors all the time, right? I mean, that's part of his appeal. So I think that he's a risk taker, and I think that he's completely flown in the face of all ethics laws. Look, he should have divested himself of all of his holdings and his family, frankly, of all of his holdings, you know, who are also, in many cases, serving in the administration. And he refused to do that. And he's sort of, by, you know, just his nature, flying in the face of all ethical laws and just hoping that at some point, you know, he's not going to get taken down for that because he's the president. Right. So it's much more of a model that is similar to some sort of, you know, African dictatorship, like, you know, Zaire under Mobutu, where, you know, profits accrue to the top, and that this is kind of more of like a billionaire big man, you know, sort of rule rather than, you know, the democratic traditions that we've typically had in the United States.
Professor Mitchell Orenstein, who is a professor of Russian and East European Studies at Harvard and also the University of Pennsylvania. America's treatment of refugees has come under international condemnation. But the feeling that many Americans seem to have is it's time to take care of Americans first before we worry about anybody else, regardless of how desperate their conditions are. Beth Farmer is the director of Refugees Northwest, and we spoke to her about where these refugees and asylum seekers are coming from, what they're fleeing, and how our policies have changed.
Well, refugees, we set a ceiling every year. The president sets a ceiling, and they set exactly where we're going to take those people from. And so people are processed overseas. So when people get here as refugees, they've gone through an extreme amount of both security vetting and medical vetting, and they're coming here through the State Department.
So you're expecting everybody that you have?
Absolutely. They're secured before they get here.
And that includes asylum seekers as well, because right now we do have the issue at the southern border with people claiming asylum entering illegally.
It's a little bit different with asylum seekers than it is with refugees. Because we set a ceiling every year and we say these are the places we'll take them from, it leaves out a vast majority of the world. And many of those countries have extreme human rights issues. So if you are gay and you are in Cameroon and it is illegal to be gay in Cameroon, you can be jailed for 5 years for being gay. If you are a human rights activist and you are in Pakistan, or if you are a woman's rights activist, or if you're Christian in China, we are not taking refugees from any of those places. And so as part of international law, and part of our own domestic law in the United States, part of our own federal law, we allow people to ask for protection after they get to the United States. And that is called asylum. And so that is the only way that these people will secure a type of protection, which is like a refugee status. But whereas refugees are processed overseas, asylum seekers must get to U.S. soil first and then ask for protection.
Is it by whatever means? Because how do you interpret then what's happening at the U.S.-Mexico border where people from Honduras are crossing illegally, quote unquote, because they're not going through a border check place? Does that count as asylum, and do you agree with them being put in detention centers?
That's a great question. So there's a couple of issues there. One is we have been following for over a year that many people are trying to cross legally at the entry points, and they have been turned away. In fact, there are multiple lawsuits around this. They are being told erroneous information that we have reached our quota of asylum seekers. We have no quota. They are being told that the U.S. no longer accepts asylum. And there are many, many people who are trying to enter legally who are going back 6, 7, 8, 9 times, sleeping on the streets without food, without clothing, without care, that then are being forced to enter through another means and then being are essentially being forced to enter illegally and then being prosecuted for it. But the U.S. historically has also recognized that not everybody knows how to enter legally. Not everybody knows how to enter legally. Many people are fleeing extreme torture and human rights abuses, and they're getting here any means they can. And oftentimes what we have seen in the past is they throw themselves on the first Border Patrol officer they see, and they say, "I am here to seek asylum." And in the past, those folks have said, okay, let's start the process. Now they're being told you're entering illegally, and therefore we're going to prosecute you criminally.
Why do you think that desperation is not believed by some?
I think until you really get to know people's stories and you sit with them, you don't know. And when I have worked with people, and I've worked with people from over 70 countries, but some of the worst abuses that I have seen, and I've worked with people who have existed in extreme war-torn areas. Some of the worst abuses I have seen have been in Central America. I have worked with teenagers who have seen, in one particular case, their father dismembered in front of them from El Salvador, mm-hmm. so that was a warning to the family. I have worked with young boys who refused to join gangs, who were forcibly held down and branded with cattle brands branded to the gang. I have worked with women who have been young teenage girls who have been gang raped, people who have walked down streets of their town and seen bodies hanging from lampposts as warning to the populace, and who have gone to the police and asked for help, only to find out that police are in collusion with the gangs and they have been retaliated against. We have people who have seen their family members burned alive inside their houses. And I think that type of horror, the type of horror that is so disturbing, people can't get their brains around it, and so they reject it. It's been my experience as a social worker for more than 28 years now, that people make rational choices. And these journeys that these people make are horrific. And if there was an easier way to do it, they would do it. No one wants to put themselves at risk of being raped or dying of dehydration in the desert. In my experience, everybody loves their children and they want them to have good lives. Nobody puts their children at risk of these things unless the thing they are fleeing from is worse.
That's pretty intense. So what to do? More from Beth Farmer, Director of Refugees Northwest, after the break. Back to Beth Farmer, the Director of Refugees Northwest. There is clearly a growing fear in this country that we are being overrun by criminals from abroad trying to sneak into the country. So we asked Beth, and she works with refugees every day. She's done it for years. Who exactly are these people coming to the Northwest? Why are they leaving their homes, and why are there so many children?
The vast majority are coming with kids for their kids, because it's easy to stay in a war-torn area if it's just yourself. But when you think, my children will never get an education, my children might be blown up, you will do anything. You will risk anything to get your children to safety. And it's no different. When people flee Iraq with their kids, that's not some simple journey. People don't get to Jordan from Iraq and people say, why'd you take that journey? Why? Why would you put your children at risk? Why would you take that journey? We see people who take months to get out of the Congo, months to get out of Iraq. They walk, they ride, they beg, they get robbed, they get raped. All of these things happen for every migrant who makes this journey. Getting out of a country and fleeing extreme violence to get to safety is never easy. That is the journey of a refugee and an asylum seeker. That's just part of it.
And they get here and they confront somebody who says, oh, we think you're making up your story. Do people make up stories?
You know, it's been so the asylum process is so difficult. Most people who cross at a border and ask for asylum are detained. And we see detentions last for about a year at the Northwest Detention Center in Tacoma. So you're essentially in jail for a year for asking for protection. Even if you've crossed legally, you are detained for a year. If, for instance, and I'm old enough to remember when, like, the Bolshoi ballet would come over and they would defect, right? They were essentially seeking asylum.
And they were considered heroes.
Right. They were essentially seeking asylum. So that would be considered an affirmative or asylum case and you're out in the community. It will take, on average here, 4 to 5 years for your case to be processed. During the vast majority of that time, you are not allowed to work and you can't collect any benefits. So you are extremely poor. You are very vulnerable. You are living off the compassion of others. Often people are supported by churches, by community members. We have people who come into our office that are seeking asylum to get one meal a day. You know, they're cup of noodles that we give them. There are no welfare benefits awaiting them.
So churches have to finance this themselves.
Not only churches, but wonderful community members. That's where we raise money every year to feed for emergency food program, clothe, to give people toothbrushes and toothpaste. They are not living high off the hog.
World is a cruel place. If everybody who found themselves in a horrible situation such as you described were to come here, even you would be overwhelmed, wouldn't you?
But that's not what we see has happened historically. That's not what happens. Most people prefer to stay home. Most people will wait many years before fleeing and then will wait in exile many, many more years. Most people prefer to stay in places that speak their own language. This is not a new process. The United States has taken refugees since the beginning of the United States. I mean, what were the pilgrims but religious refugees? After World War II, we started a specific humanitarian program for refugees because of what happened in World War II, because of the concentration camps, because there were people who tried to flee here, who couldn't flee here because they couldn't do it through the normal visa process. We turned away a boat off the coast of Cuba and Florida that was full of people that were Jewish, that were trying to flee Europe. And many of them, they were turned around, sent back home. Many of them perished in the Holocaust. We voted down a Senate bill to take Jewish children to give them safety here during the war. And many of those children perished in the Holocaust. And there was deep soul searching after World War II. And we developed both the humanitarian refugee program, and we signed on to international treaties to take asylum seekers. And so this has been in place since 1951. And thus far, we have not been overwhelmed. Thus far, we have managed it. And these people have become the fabric of our community, and they have become people's grandparents and great-grandparents and parents, from whether it's from Poland or Czechoslovakia or Somalia or Russia or any of the former Soviet Union places. We now think of them as the guy in the shop, the guy who does our coffee, the guy who's our carpenter, our lawyer. But most of us come from these backgrounds. And so I get that fear. I get that people are afraid of being overwhelmed. But most people don't take this journey unless it's absolutely necessary for their lives. They don't. And thus far, we've been doing this for 80 years, and we have not been overwhelmed yet. We can manage this process. And to your point about asylum seekers, the vetting is very rigorous. Most asylum seekers are turned around and deported. There's only a small percentage. And those who can really make their case legally and go through an extreme security check that are actually approved for asylum. So there is an extremely rigorous process. Just because somebody says, I want asylum, doesn't mean they get it. They go through an extremely rigorous process, and they are not afforded representation during that process. They have to find it themselves. And so, you know, we have checks and balances in place. We've been doing this for a long time. We're good at it.
Beth Farmer, Director of Refugees Northwest. We're going to post the whole thing on the Ross File podcast. And what I came away with after talking with Beth, Colleen, is that we're all in this to make America a stronger country. Well, unless you've been in combat, every single one of these people is stronger than you, is tougher than you. The men, the women, the kids, to make a journey like this. First of all, for what they've endured and been through, and then for what they went through to get here. You imagine, let's say your neighborhood suddenly falls apart in some dystopian future. You decide to escape to Canada and you have no money and no car and sometimes no shoes. You're going to make it? And yet that's the kind of journey that these people have done.
And I think it's interesting, too, and we talked to her for a long time, so I'm glad we're posting the whole thing online, is just coming away with a reasonable conversation, a rational conversation from somebody who is working on the front lines of asylum refugee seekers. You know, to get the actual information from the front lines, I think, is a lot more calming, a lot less frightening than what we're hearing in mainstream rhetoric.
Yeah.
Come on in. See what's new.
Things sure are changing around here, that's for sure. Here's Felix Bunnell, brought to you by the King County Library System. The Sears Overlake store is closing.
Yeah, I shouldn't be laughing. I was just laughing at that, but things are changing around here.
Yeah.
That big Overlake store was originally known as Overlake Park. It's closing this Sunday after nearly 47 years of operation. Opened up back in November 1971 when it was pretty much the only retail store within miles. But it was very close to where State Route 520 would soon be built, then called the Evergreen Freeway. And it literally straddles the Bellevue-Redmond border, kind of ground zero for all the massive growth that's happened here since World War II, really. I mean, it was a good retail bet to put a store there. But it's not just the Overlake store. Sears has been closing a lot of stores lately. Shoreline shut down, Federal Way, Chehalis, Tacoma Mall is supposed to close in September. And they have about 42 stores remaining in Washington after this round of closures. These include these franchise-like things called hometown stores. So there's only about six or seven of the actual big box stores around the state. And nationwide, there'll be 800 Sears left at the end of this year, down from a high of 4,000 as recently as 2012, which almost seems unbelievable to me.
So what happened?
Well, you know, a lot of things happened. I think the 21st century happened. but that, you know, that the weird thing about Sears, they were founded in 1886, but they didn't get into retail stores until 1925.
Yeah.
So they had 39 years of just doing catalogs.
I mean,
Jeff Bezos
Amazon.
Is 39 years old, right? That's how long Sears went from being a catalog retailer to actually opening a store in 1925. So, you know, that the big Sears store downtown famously turned into Amazon headquarters 20 years ago. So it's kind of a
Starbucks
slow...
Starbucks headquarters.
What did I say, Amazon? Oh, yeah, Starbucks. Yeah. Confusing my local stores. Anyway, so a few days ago, I went and stood out at what might someday be called the northeast corner of Alhazen Street and Lumiere Avenue. We'll get back to the street names in a moment, but I did some old person on the street comments the way Phil Johnson taught me when I was an intern here in 1991.
Johnson, yes.
Yeah. I spoke with a guy named Eric from South Bellevue who appeared to be in his 50s. He was getting his tire fixed a few blocks away and had some time to kill. He'd bought some clothes at Sears. He said he's been shopping there for 30 years, and he was downright philosophical.
I think it's sad because, you know, Sears used to rule the world, and so it's just another change, and guys at the top eventually don't stay at the top, and so, yeah, it's a change of times.
I also talked to Leah, a mom in her 30s who drove over from Seattle with her two young kids. She was feeling the loss of the store. You know, she shopped there since she was a kid, but she didn't hesitate to take some responsibility for the place shutting down.
I'm sad because it's the only place that sells Land's End and Dockers.
And why do you think it's closing?
Because we shop on Amazon.
So it's your fault? You're acknowledging it's your fault?
Yes, yes. It is nice to have the convenience of just going in and trying on the clothes versus sending them back in the mail. I have very particular kids who like things to fit, right? And I can't do that online. I can only do that by going to the store.
So there's no doubt that e-commerce has decimated big box 20th century retail, but it seems to me that the store closures by Sears are about more than just economics or changing habits. Seems like there's more to it. I asked Leah if Sears had lost their mojo, and she said yes.
They have not kept up with the styles, I believe. They have good quality, but what they offer has not kept up with the times, and probably especially with the store remodeling, and it feels a little like a Kmart.
Did you shop at Sears with your kids?
Oh, yeah. As a kid, I went to the hardware section all the time. I went to the tools section all the time as an adult, Craftsman tools and the whole thing. Mm-hmm. It became a really weird mix of this store for men, and then it tried to turn into a clothing shop for men and women,
mm-hmm.
and sort of lost its identity. And I think they sold off the Craftsman brand.
They
long
did,
ago,
yeah, they made, they? Yeah, very recently. And it's my parents immigrated here in the 1950s, and Sears was like a one stop American supply store. Everything you needed to be an American was right there. And I was partial to the Scouting Supply Shop, where I got my little Cub Scout grooming kit and my collapsible cup, which I tried to find for this morning's piece, but I couldn't find it. Anyway, back to Eric from South Bellevue again. He nailed it as far as the economics and the East Side real estate market are concerned.
I see it as a market correction. Yeah, especially here with real estate so expensive. And so you got all these strip malls and priorities are changing. And so the land here is worth a lot. Sears is not, but the land is worth a lot, and especially with light rail and Microsoft just over there.
Light rail comes in 2023, and real estate is very valuable. It turns out a company with offices in New York and California called Seritage now owns most of that land where the Sears building is. They're floating a plan for something called Overlake Plaza to redevelop that property with hotels, like 9-story hotel, 9-story office, residential, park-like spaces, and these pretentious new street names for some curvy streets, including Northeast Alhazen Street, named after the famous mathematician, Lumiere Avenue, and Da Vinci Avenue. Hard to imagine that in little hardscrabble Bellevue, where I was born nearly 50 years ago.
Did I hear you say hardscrabble Bellevue?
Yeah, after World War II, up through the 70s, Bellevue was still pretty hardscrabble. Anyway, there's a public hearing coming up next Tuesday in Redmond, and we have links at My Northwest.
Curvy streets need really Tony names. Historian Felix Bonnell, he joins us every Wednesday, and you can find all his stories at MyNorthwest.com. This is Seattle's Morning News. Dave Ross with Colleen O'Brien. I'm sure that a lot of you who are my age, in your 60s, are wondering when your kids are going to have kids. Because it turns out that young American couples just aren't having as many babies as you might expect. So Claire Kane Miller from the New York Times decided to find out why. She took a novel approach. She asked them, how did you pick your research sample, Claire?
We worked with a polling firm called Morning Consult. So they have a very big sample. They do nationally representative polls all the time. And we chose people 20 to 45 because that's generally what researchers consider to be sort of childbearing years.
All right, 20 to 45. And what did they tell you?
They told us that there were sort of two groups of reasons. One was that they felt that they had more of a choice than previous generations. They wanted more leisure time. They wanted more personal freedom. They wanted to travel or pursue hobbies outside their job, and they wanted to have time to do those things. And especially the women that I did follow-up interviews with said, we are just really glad that we can make this choice. But the other set of reasons was a little bit more dreary, and those were economic reasons. Essentially, this is the first generation to have no guarantee that they're going to do better than their parents did. They have record student debt. Many of them can't buy houses. And in general, they don't feel financially secure enough to have children. They want to wait until they are. And in a lot of cases, that means waiting until their mid or late 30s. And at that point, they just can't have kids. So another big piece of this is not just choosing not to have any children at all, but ending up being able to have fewer children than you wanted.
Is it because of those annual surveys that we hear all the time saying, and the current cost of raising a kid now is $120,000 a year? Is that scaring people off?
I think that's probably, you know, part of it. There's other factors too. College is really expensive, and they know that saving for their kid to go to college is expensive, and they don't want their kids to be saddled with the same kind of student debt that they have. Parenting has really gotten more intensive, especially for middle class and upper middle class families. There's a lot more expectation that, you know, you sign them up for camps and you spend a lot of one-on-one time with them, and you know, maybe sign them up for foreign language and all these things, and they just don't feel they have the resources to do that. And, you know, they want to be able to raise their kids in a safe neighborhood, maybe in a house with a yard, and they don't feel that they can pay a mortgage. So there's a lot of financial considerations going into it.
But some of these, I mean, some of these people who say they're under financial pressure are people who hold pretty good jobs, aren't they?
Absolutely. Some of the people that I interviewed, you know, were both members of the couple worked full time in professional jobs. They had advanced degrees, and they still didn't feel that they could swing it quite yet. And they were in their early 30s, the example I'm thinking of. And the reason is, you know, together they graduated with six figures in undergraduate debt and then went on to pursue graduate degrees. And they just don't feel it's responsible to have children before they've paid off their own debt. Other people said that they wanted to make sure that they were able to earn enough that their children wouldn't have to go and then take out loans. So, you know, we've been hearing a lot about the shrinking of the middle class in America and how it's become a lot harder to achieve what your parents had. And I think this is a really real example of that in progress, that even when people have these good jobs and these degrees, that they don't feel they can swing it.
Okay, so then which couples are having kids? Which income levels are reproducing?
The only group of women for whom the fertility rate is increasing is women over 40, which is pretty astonishing because
really, that
by that point, fertility is very low. You know, most people are done having babies by 40. That's the only group for whom it's increasing. And what the researchers say is that these are people who have waited until they finished their education, until they paid off their student loans, until they felt that they were a place in their career where they could, you know, maybe take a step back to have children. And all of that didn't happen until they were over 40.
So, well, what's strange is, so people who can really, in fact, afford to have children, or you'd think would be able to afford to have children, not having as many as before. And that's fine. I mean, people have a choice and they should exercise that choice. The only problem I have is at the same time, these fertility rates of native-born Americans are dropping. We're also cutting off the immigrant supply. And unless a country has young, vigorous people, its economy is going to founder. So is anybody concerned about that?
People are extremely concerned about the fertility rate falling because of, you know, being able to support the social safety net, so pay for Social Security, being able to take care of elderly people, being able to fill the labor force, all of these things. One answer is certainly immigration. However, often there's the group of people who are most concerned about the fertility rate falling are also tend to be anti-immigration just by their political views. It's fears about, you know, the demographics of the country changing and who the babies are who are going to form the next generation.
Claire Kane Miller writes for The Upshot of The New York Times. Her latest piece is called Americans Are Having Fewer Babies. They Told Us Why. Claire, thank you.
Thanks for having me.
Sports Insider brought to you by your Western Washington Toyota dealers. Here he is, Danny O'Neill. Mariners lost 9-3 last night. Shellacked by the Angels. Explain to me this concept. I'm trying to learn new things every day, as you know. Ryan Divish writes that Mike Leake, the pitcher, he had problems last night, but it's his style to, quote, give up contact. What does that mean?
It means he doesn't pitch for strikeouts, that he is not a guy who is going to look. He wants opponents to put the ball in play, and he wants to, by the types of pitches that he throws, he wants to give up. He wants them to swing and put the ball in play on pitches that he thinks will produce outs.
I see. So he deliberately throws things that they can hit, but hit into the glove of an outfielder somewhere.
Yeah. There's actually that idea that the batting average on a ball in play, there's very little evidence that a pitcher controls that. That a pitcher is more likely to produce outs with pitches that he throws than. That if the ball's put in play, the pitcher at that point doesn't have much control in dictating.
So my next question is this a flawed concept, and should he change his style based on things like what happened last night?
No, because that's going to happen with a pitcher like Mike Leake, who doesn't have a high strikeout rate. The best thing for a pitcher is to have a high swing and miss rate, where opposing batters are swinging and missing at his pitches because there's no chance for an error. There's no chance that the ball is hit somewhere a fielder isn't. Those are also the most valuable pitchers. It's really expensive to get those guys. Mike Leake doesn't have the stuff. He doesn't throw hard enough. He doesn't have the movement on his pitches to be a strikeout pitcher. Hence, when the Mariners acquired him a year ago, St. Louis is still paying part of his salary. Like that, they gave up some of the money to pay for his salary when they traded him to the Mariners. And the reason he is not as valuable as another pitcher is because he doesn't have a high strikeout rate. He does very well in being an effective pitcher given the stuff he has. He's never, you can't train him to be a strikeout pitcher. That's not in his makeup. But you can, he is someone who likes to work fast, has a rhythm, and has been a very effective pitcher for the Mariners this season, even though he is not, he has a below average fastball. He does not throw as hard as your average major leaguer.
All right, let's move to the grievances filed against the NFL owners, their policy on the anthem. What's this about?
Well, the NFL Players Association is essentially arguing that the owners have done something that constitutes an end run around the collective bargaining agreement. Mm. And their rule, which states if you're on the field, you're required to stand. And you're not required to be on the field, but if you are on the field, you're required to stand, is not kosher with what the negotiated agreement is. We'll see where that goes. I think at the time the NFL did it, this to me seems like a pretty ineffective half measure. It doesn't eliminate the players who are not standing. It just puts them out of sight, but people are going to still see when they enter the field after the anthem and know. Or you'll have scenarios where entire teams aren't on the field.
Or they'll have social media. They can post what they're doing in the locker room, this and that. I mean, instead of sitting down and talking with the players, instead of starting a conversation about, all right, why are you kneeling, this and that, the NFL did something that just essentially cut off the conversation and made them look like the villain.
Yeah, I don't think it made them look like the villain. They're trying to shift the responsibility to the players. They're trying to prevent to be targets from Donald Trump, quite frankly. I mean, that's honestly what they're doing, is that that when Trump gets up there and says, I wish these guys would make the players stand, they're saying all the players on the field are standing. You go talk. But at the same time, they don't want to appear overly draconian and dictating a rule. In my mind, the NFL owners, the NBA players all stand for the national anthem. Mm-hmm. Why is that?
Yeah, but they also wear shirts.
No. Well, they have
their own form of protest.
Specifically, it's not about the level of protest in my mind. It's specifically about the anthem. Mm-hmm. If you don't want to protest during the national anthem, put it in the rule book. And if you're going to put it in the rule book as an NFL owner, it's in the NBA players' rule book because it was negotiated in there. Yeah. And if you want that, and nobody thinks that NBA players aren't able to properly demonstrate or to show their activism, NFL players have found something that makes fans very uncomfortable. Mm. Some fans, very uncomfortable. And
is
to me,
is it making an impact on the NFL's bottom line?
There's a lot of debates about that. The most recent story that I've seen is that TV viewership of the NFL is down, but it's not down as much as overall television viewership.
Because of the anthem stuff?
Well, you can't. It's drawing that line because people will tell you why they do things. The fact is that NFL viewership is not down as much as overall TV viewership. There were less people watching, but there were more people that continued to watch the NFL than continued to watch other television. Does it affect their bottom line? It certainly makes it political. But then you have Michael Bidwell, who is the owner of the Arizona Cardinals, sending out a message of support for the most recent Supreme Court justice nominee, talking about how he's known him since high school, known him for 37 years. And that's political. That went out on the team account, and it's on the team website. Yeah. So there definitely is a double standard in the types of political expression that NFL owners are comfortable with. But that idea of, in my mind, if the NFL owners did not want players to demonstrate it all during the national anthem, there's a very simple answer, which is give them enough money to reopen the collective bargaining agreement and put a rule in there in place similar to what's in the NBA collective bargaining agreement.
Danny O'Neill. Thanks, Danny.
You bet. Talk to you soon.
Sports Insider brought to you by your Western Washington Toyota dealers.